All right. Good morning, everybody. So in the last class, we just kind of cut off right in the middle, and that's kind of by intention. We're going to front load all of the Lamentations lessons and just really kind of hammer in on what we're learning, the lessons that we learned, and we'll kind of go a little faster towards the end. So again, bear with me. We may still be behind after today's lesson, but the next two will both be for chapter 3. That'll be a good time to catch up. So we'll get back on time. Second thing, it was brought to my attention that when I printed out the lessons, the answers are on the matching section. Y'all were all trying to get by on me, but Paige showed it to me this morning. So I don't know if the white didn't print or if it did print.
It was your fault.
It was my fault, yeah. So anyway, you've got the answers now, so we're not going to be asking them. We're just going to go through that. But still,
which is good, because I'll admit the matching exercise today was not very good.
Oh, they're no good this one? Okay. Well, I'll be doing it.
Full credit for everybody.
Yeah. So y'all just still look at it, you know, match everything up, but of course you're going to have the answer. So
I'm so dumb, I didn't know about the answer.
So she, today's lesson has it. And then I was like, did the other one have it? She went back to it. Oh, it was on 6-2. So anyway.
If you want to challenge yourselves, I can print off the ones that don't have the answers.
Yeah.
Or I think I'll get any tapers.
I could print a CD and I'll be like, maybe it's the right answer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So anyway, we're going to do something kind of weird this morning, at least it feels weird to me, is since we cut off halfway through the last class, we're really going to just jump right into it. I'm not going to do a whole bunch of intro slides, which usually is a nice way to kind of ease everyone's mind into it. You're going to have to shake off whatever you were thinking about earlier today, and we're going to dive straight into Lamentations here, okay? So if y'all remember, the first 11 verses, get your Bibles open to chapter 1, the first 11 verses was this description of the destruction of Jerusalem. And then we transitioned to 12 verses 17, which is kind of the lament of their condition. All right, so I'm going to read those again. That's how we ended the last class. That's going to be kind of our lead-in here. We're going to read 12 through 17 again and be thinking about back from lesson 6 or whatever, question number 2, which I think has several answers in these verses. But why does Jerusalem weep? Okay, which is a... Oh, yeah, so we're going to look through this. So, starting in verse 12. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. From on high he sent fire, into my bones he made it descend. He spread a net for my feet. He turned me back. He has left me stunned, faint all the day long. My transgressions were bound into a yoke. By his hand they were fastened together. They were set upon my neck. He caused my strength to fail. The Lord gave me into the hands of those whom I cannot withstand. The Lord rejected all my mighty men in my midst. He summoned an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep. My eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbor should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. All right, so from those verses, I think there's one kind of real solid answer, and there's a lot of others that are, you know, lean into it as well. Why does Jerusalem weep?
Well, I think the obvious answer is what God has done.
Yeah, because of all of these things, you can kind of encapsulate it all in what God has done. Are there any specifics y'all want to pull out? What specifically has he done?
Well, she says, it says directly, there's a comforter far from her, far from me. So they have no one to comfort them.
Right.
Specifically.
I think that's the big one. All right. A lot of things have happened. But, you know, 16, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. Other versions say the comforter. Okay. This is not, I think the word is parakletos. which is the name that's often used for the Holy Spirit, which means comforter. It's not that word, but when he says be comforter, I think we understand to know what he's saying there. That's God, and it's crushing that Jerusalem is separated from God. All the other stuff, the pain and the suffering, that's one thing, but you're now separated from God. That is a dark and terrible consequence. And that's terrible for anybody. But remember who is personified here. This is Jerusalem. This is effectively God's home on earth. These are His people. They don't, or at least shouldn't know this type of separation. You know, think about your mother or your father, you know, leaving you, or a spouse leaving, and just nothing to do with you anymore. You've lost that. It's cut off. That's an empty feeling and an expression of this lament that I think is really powerful. Because, you know what I don't want to feel again? Read through this. I'm going to remember that. I don't want to feel that separation again. You know, I wrote this in tears. I weep for this. That's what he's saying. So we had a thought question in the lesson number two. Did you guys notice the only questions asked in this lament? What one thing does Jerusalem want to know? It's the only question mark I found.
The first sentence.
Yeah, back in verse 12. Yeah, is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Why would this be asked? What do you think? What's he thinking here?
Well, it may go to the end of the statement about seeking comfort. That he would think somebody watching this calamity that they might reach out in compassion,
right,
and do something. And it's as if there is none.
Right. Yeah, you think about somebody. Did you have something?
What Danny said, I totally agree with, and also I didn't really understand it until I think you read in chapter 2, and I can't think of the exact verses, but how others are coming by, you know, not God's people, they're coming by, they're kind of, you become the laughing stock, or you become, look down on that, you know, your God couldn't take care of you, and right. You said you had this great land that God had provided, yet now look at it, and I think they're maybe appealing to God's, if pride's the right word, but, taking up for himself. It's just nothing for you to see these people walking by and kind of wagging their fingers at this.
Yeah, that goes all the way back to Genesis, or Exodus, whenever Moses would intervene, God would say, hey, the other nations are going to see what you're doing, and they're going to realize, or they're going to think, you couldn't get your people out of Egypt. Like, it's kind of a concern for God there. And, here in Lamentations, is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? I think Jeremiah is wanting to draw attention to everyone seeing this, like, look. Look at how bad things are. This is the consequence of sin. And he asked it like, do you not care? How could you not care? And I think the sad answer to that is that they don't care. I think about, even right now, the war in Ukraine and the suffering they're going through. And we show those pictures from Aleppo and the Syrian war. These atrocities are being committed there. Suffering that we'll hopefully never know. But it doesn't keep me up at night. And, I say that kind of bluntly, but, like, I don't know those people. I don't know anything about them. It's on the other side of the world. I have, kind of a general human compassion for them, but I don't know them at all. And I think that's what's going on here. Like, these people, they don't know Jerusalem. They just know of them. They know that they've been kind of a thorn in their side for a while. They're not feeling the pain like the people in there living it are. And that's, it just feels weird, like, look at what we're going through. Does no one care? And they're just passing by. I forget. There's a word for that. The idea of when somebody suffers in public and people will just walk by, not paying any attention to it. And it's because you're like, somebody else is probably dealing with that, or I have nothing to do with that. And some people thankfully don't do that. But that feeling is there. And that's what he's kind of calling out to. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? This, again, is the consequence of sin, and it's kind of worse than they thought. Another reason for writing lament, he's identified a fundamental tragedy of being human, this type of thing. Sin is costly, and this is what it looks like. And when you read this, I don't want that. You know, I want God and I want a relationship with Him and what He offers, you know, not this. So let's move to verse 18 to 20. I think these verses are the key verses of chapter 1. Okay, so I'm going to read 18 to 20. The Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against His word. But hear, all you peoples, and see my suffering. My young women and my young men have gone into captivity. I called to my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and elders perished in the city while they sought food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, for I am in distress. My stomach churns, my heart is wrung within me, because I have been very rebellious. In the street, the sword bereaves. In the house, it is like death. So what is this key confession? This was one of our objectives. What is the key confession that is made here? Whose fault was this? Theirs. It was their fault. They did this. All this destruction that I just described, the terrible condition that we're in, verse 18 is correct. We're suffering because we have rebelled. And, you know, why is that statement so important? Maybe you know it, but why is it so important to make that statement aloud here and admit it?
Well, after you admit it, God's not going to come and help you do anything.
Right.
He's going to continue to be against you.
Right. Yeah. And you see what's happening when he's against you.
Yeah. One thing that's striking to me, and this is not consistent with many that complain, is that people want to blame God for their circumstances. Where was God? I prayed and He did not answer. He wasn't here. And yet here in this statement, which I find quite profound, the Lord is righteous.
Right.
The very first thing that is acknowledged is God's righteousness in this. And that's the beginning of repentance.
Right.
When we understand God's role in my life in
that
way.
And I think, I mean, it means God's people are learning, right? They're learning from their past mistakes to some degree, at least Jeremiah is. And when God reveals His word throughout the Old Testament, it's important that the people actually listen and learn as we're going through this. And they are. They're kind of like, you know, rebellious teenagers now. They're not children anymore. They know a little more than they used to. And rebellious is kind of a good word for that. Like, we knew, but we still bucked up against it. You know, we went against it, and now we're feeling the consequences of that. They're not newborn anymore. Think of Job and perhaps how little he knew of, like, the full plan, the full picture of God, you know, what he knew compared to the later generations who had the prophets, you know, and examples, direct revelation from God. So I think one of the purposes of a lament is to expose our inner selves, you know, and learn from that. And this is a positive example of that. It's what we want for our kids, right? You know, we don't expect them to get it right all the time when they're babies. We don't even expect them to get it all right as teenagers or adults, but we expect them to learn, you know, right, to get that better, to improve over time. And laments are a way of processing those feelings and seeing where you stand. You know, have I learned? What can I learn from this? What can I look back on later and see this? And then in this case, you know, he's saying we're reaping what we've sown, and that's going to inform them as they move forward. You either keep drowning in those mistakes or you're going to move forward and do better. And I really think verse 20 sums it up really well and just an appropriate feeling. You know, where he says, I'm in distress, my stomach churns. You know, it's like a feeling deep inside. My heart is wrung within me because I've been very rebellious. In the street, the sword bereaves, and the house is like death. This is something that's just like eating up his insides, and that's kind of a good feeling. You're feeling like, wait a minute, I did wrong, and man, I feel sick to my stomach because of it. I'm going to do better and build from that. All right, but Jerusalem asks for something. Remember, it was personified as a widow here. Asks for something in these last two verses. So let's read 21 and 22. They heard my groaning, yet there is no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. You have brought the day you announced. Now let them be as I am. Let all their evil doing come before you, and deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my transgressions. For my groans are many, and my heart is faint. So, I mean, she's effectively asking for
Yeah.
Punish them too. Punish others for their iniquity. Like, yeah, I'm getting punished for mine, but everyone else should be feeling the same wrath, right? You know, and why would she follow up an admission of guilt? What we just read, this kind of understanding that we're suffering for the reason of our rebellion and sin, with a request to make others, you know, suffer the same consequence. Why do you think that transition, that leap in the mind would be made?
God's righteousness.
God's righteousness. Justice. I want justice. We're getting it now. I've admitted that. We're getting that justice, and I want that to keep occurring everywhere, because that's what I can base my faith on. That justice is being doled out correctly everywhere, not just on me. If you come to the conclusion that what is happening is just, and I think also rightly conclude that that is what you want, you know, I want justice. If I sin, if I do exactly what God told me not to do, you know, I want Him to do the same thing, or otherwise He's false. Go ahead.
Is this where we might say the how long question? I mean, could this be implied?
I think so. I mean, you can imply it in a lot of places. Any time that he says anything that you kind of imply the this is bad, I don't want it to be like this for very long. Yeah, I think so. Kind of hear how long before you judge the other nations. You know, we're kind of getting it right now, but I'd kind of like to know, like, is it going to be tomorrow, you know, that they start suffering as well, or is it down the line? You know, you start wondering that.
Daniel?
Yes.
Also in this verse, think of, yes, God's justice to be done on them, but also you can see the trust that, although the, you know, the writer, you can see the trust that the writer has in God, because trust that God's still their God and they're still His people, because He didn't just get rid of them. You know, he's trusting enough to know that God hadn't just forgotten about them forever. Because they sin, he's like, you know, God, you told us in verse 21, you have brought the day that you announced. Like, you told us you're going to do this, because if we sin like this,
right?
But now, you know, bring us back and take care of these evil people. So he's still showing that trust in God.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's showing that trust in us. We're happy that he's come to that point. But what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if they're suffering, if the other people are suffering, they don't have time to make fun or be glad about Israel's suffering.
Right.
Because they're going to be dealing with their own.
Exactly, yeah. And you kind of, you know, we all have that sense of wanting justice inside of us. You know, we don't work real hard at, you know, desiring justice, and then we just want that. We want to see the right thing happen. But what is frustrating about this process for them? Like, they're feeling right now, they're getting judged by who? On earth.
Wicked,
yeah. The Babylonians, these are not people that, you know, you're thinking like, well, yeah, they're pretty good. They're following God, so that's why he's using them. What's frustrating about that? You know, you think about the timeline of it. It doesn't always happen on our time frame, does it? Justice, it's not given out exactly when we want it sometimes. And this is where I think we as New Testament Christians, you know, we're able to learn and build on what the previous generations had learned. You know, this lament is a little more mature than the other ones in that, you know, the lamenter understands the why, he doesn't ask the why. But then when Jesus came, what was one of his major messages? You know, just, you don't just think about your transient life, your ephemeral life. It's, think about your eternal life. It's a much longer timeline, right? You know, your eternal soul. We think about things above. We remember that we're pilgrims. Our home is elsewhere. Did you have a comment?
Well, you're kind of touching on what I was going to say. Because I tend to take it a little bit further than what's right here. I understand he's saying, you know, I'm suffering. You know, the people are suffering. So, you know, I want that to, you know, cause my enemies to suffer.
Yeah.
But I think... because he just talked about and started, you know, God's righteousness and as the beginning of the repentance, like Danny said, I think as Christians we need to pray for our enemies to also, you know, if they're going to bring them around to a repentance and a love for God as opposed. So I know what that is saying, but I just kind of feel like, as Christians, we take it a little bit further.
Right,
like you say, the eternal.
Because aren't we glad that he doesn't judge us immediately for some of the things, you know, that we do? We like having that, whatever you want to call it, grace period where he's patient with us and extends that out. You know, perhaps we should hope for the same for our enemies. If they're doing wrong, like, it sure is frustrating, especially when we're down, they're kicking us, you know. But I would like that same grace to be extended to them. You know, God's justice is on his timeline, which is sometimes hard. But I think it teaches us to have hearts like God, not like children. You know, if God always immediately rebuked me for what I do wrong, I may stop doing a lot of wrong things, you know, because I'm going to get that immediate feedback of do wrong, slap, it hurts, you know, ooh, I'm not doing that anymore. But, you know, why? Why am I stopping that? It's because I do something and I get that immediate punishment. It's fear-based. You know, the scope is limited. But when I stop doing wrong because I know it affects me eternally, and I have faith in that, my heart changes. You start doing things for a better reason, right? And I'm thinking about the why of the matter. And there's things more important than that immediate discomfort. So just like we learned to trust that for ourselves, we have to trust the same for others. Jerusalem's enemies, they will face judgment, right? In this life or the next. You know, in verse 22, their evil doing will come before God. He will deal with it. And it will be because of their transgressions at some point. They're going to feel that same grief because God is just. So do you see how we learn all of that from a poem expressing pain? You know, when you take your mind all the way through this and you're thinking through God and his character and his righteousness and why I trust him and why I'm feeling the things I do and how others are going to feel the same and why do I feel that way? All that comes out by just expressing of these things in this lament. Alright, so circling back, this was a slide that Mason put up a while back, a few classes ago. Why do believers write laments? And we asked that question at the beginning of the last class. Terrible things happen in the world, and if we believe in a just, loving God, those things should bother us. Alright, all this stuff that we just read, it should bother us. Sin is an affront to God's justice, and its consequences obscure his love. So this is one of the reasons. When faced with reality, with this reality, man has two options. You can either turn away from God, and there's a lot of different ways you can do that. You can decide he doesn't exist, so I don't care anymore, or you can decide that God doesn't have any answers. Just going, well, I'm just going to deal with it myself, because clearly he's not, you know, doing the right thing. Or you can turn to God, turn your face towards him as the only one powerful enough to fix these problems, and as the only one wise enough to offer an explanation for those horrors. And we're going to see a lot more of that through this book. So biblical laments, they bring the speaker's doubts, fears, pains, sins, struggles to God so that he can fix them because no one else can. Right? That's who we want to address our laments to. And then I want to make sure we nail down our objectives. This is the last one. We wanted to identify the contrasting messages of the chapter's style and substance. So remember, this is an acrostic. It's 22 verses, 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, very ordered, and all that, versus just the disorder and confusion of what was going on in Jerusalem and the way they feel about it. Which I think perhaps, you know, we don't know, we can speculate, perhaps is one of the reasons for the acrostic style. I don't know how to express this. Let me fit it into a very structured style. That's going to help me express it with a little more structure around it. I said to list three concerns, but there was a whole bunch of them, so y'all can pick any of these. You know, become a slave. There's nobody to comfort. We've gone into exile. We're filthy. We're mocked. You know, we're trading treasure for food. You know, trading things that are important for, you know, our daily food. And then, of course, the big one, rejected by God. And then we just did this one. We want to identify the key confession that is made. Verse 18, the Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. That's the word we want to kind of pull out of this chapter. You know, all these things happened for a reason, and it was us. All right, so that's chapter 1. Do y'all have anything that you'll want to say about that before we kind of move on to chapter 2?
So chapter 1 has a lot of, I think there are a lot of references to the historical account from Jeremiah, which we can really touch on. It's fine. But I would encourage you to go, everyone to go back and read the chapter and look for descriptions of what has happened in Jerusalem that match very closely to what Jeremiah records historically is happening. There's going to be less of that as we move forward in the book, but it's like in chapter one, he's painting the picture. He's saying, this is the scene, and now we're going to zoom in and look at how people feel about it and what effect it had on them before and after the destruction and during the siege and afterwards. But there's all those historical details that appear in chapter one anchor us in this place and time where things are going so terribly wrong.
Yeah, I think you bring out a good point there, is that he does start kind of with, you know, in general, you know, in Jeremiah, you see all the, here's what happened in general, and we're going to zoom in throughout the book. I think chapter two does this very specifically. He starts with some more general stuff and then really zooms in on the individuals. Like, here's how Israel is suffering, but here's how mothers are suffering, and here's how the priests are suffering, here's how children are suffering. He kind of goes into it. Alright, so what I wanted to start with for, well, actually, let's go through all of our stuff here. This is chapter 2, here's where we are, about halfway through the class. Okay, so I wanted to start with this question. This is a chapter about God's wrath. Alright, so y'all just shout out, what are some examples, some biblical examples of God's wrath that you can think of?
The flood.
There's a big one, right? The whole world destroyed. Okay. What was that?
Sodom
and Gomorrah. We think about that one. What else?
Adam and Eve fell from the garden.
Exactly.
Nineveh
destroyed. Yeah.
Plagues on the people as they complain to the wilderness.
Yeah, hardness of heart. They get this plague. Yeah. Good. What else? Do y'all think of any others?
There's a lot of things that about David.
Yeah. I think through the book of Numbers, good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, God's wrath on other nations. Good. And I was thinking that as they go through the wilderness, man, how many times does God get so frustrated with them? I mean, just right off the bat, grumbling about all these different things. Multiple things happen out there. You have Korah's rebellion. He sends a plague at one point that, what's the name? Phineas, is he the one that has to like fend off this plague that kills like 24,000? By basically just going to God and saying, hey, we messed up, I'm sorry. Please, you know, relent from this. Cain's curse, what else do I have in here? Jesus in the temple, think about that. God's wrath kind of being poured out in that temple. The golden calf, you know, they're drinking the gold from it. You know, God's wrath, it's throughout the Bible. But what is the common factor in all of those? Why is God angry?
Their rebellion.
Rebellion, yeah. But even broader.
Sin.
Yeah. Sin is the common factor. That he's not mad because, you know, things are kind of annoying. Stubbed his toe or stuck in traffic. You know, those types of things. He's mad at sin. And that's when his wrath gets pulled down. This chapter has a lot about God's wrath. Which, again, was written as a lament. It's helpful for us to read, helpful for someone to write and acknowledge. Can you imagine writing about the things that God doesn't like and realizing as you go, I've done some of that, you know, he told me not to do that, but I forgot and did it anyway. What a realization that would be. So this chapter is going to be a lament about God's wrath and how terrible it is. So let's read verses 1 through 9. Danny, would you mind reading that so I can stop talking so much? 1 through 9, chapter 2.
How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied all the dwelling places of Jacob. He has thrown down in his wrath the stronghold of the daughter of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel. He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire devouring all around. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow. With his right hand like an adversary, he has slain all who were pleasing to his eye. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds. He has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughters of Judah. He has done violence to his tabernacle, as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary. He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord, as on the day of a set feast. The Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and wall to lament. They languish together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed the and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord.
Thanks, Danny. I mean, this is a terrible example of God's wrath. And, you know, the main subject here is kind of Israel in general. I mean, he uses a couple of phrases talking about the priests and all that, but it's generally about their total state. All right? Now, I forgot to tell you guys to look for what jumps out to you in these verses as we go along is perhaps especially bad. So while you think about that, I'll start with this kind of combination of verse 3 and 9 about how he has withdrawn from them his right hand in the face of the enemy and her prophets. They find, you know, no vision from the Lord. The idea that God just isn't there anymore. Remember what we just talked about in chapter 1. He's not there anymore, and that's scary and depressing. And the example of God's wrath. What else did y'all see in there that really stood out to you as being especially bad?
You know, he didn't remember them at all.
Yeah. Was it Jason's talk on Wednesday about how God is able to selectively remember? We're not able to do that. And you see, like, that was a choice of God, you know, I'm going to blot them out. You know, I had chosen to forget.
You know, it's one thing for him, like, to destroy the palaces, you know, that was the, you know, the kings and the establishment that should have, you know, the shepherds that were supposed to be the ones that led by example.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you would think, you know, they trusted in the walls, the fortifications, instead of God, and you would see maybe why that was removed. But God's temple, God's worship, all of that, God removed.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, when I think like that, you know, what would they have looked at? Like in Jeremiah 7, they said, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Yeah. They could have put their trust in that.
Yeah.
But God said, no, you don't put your trust in the structure, you put your trust in me.
Right.
And so here he removes all that.
Right.
And he takes away the very thing that maybe they could have had hoped in.
Right. And how scary would that be? I mean, he has dwelt among them for how many years at this point? You know, the tabernacle, the sanctuary, you've got the temple, and all this is being destroyed. What an empty feeling that's going to be. Jack, do you have something?
I was going to say, generally, what jumps out at me is just God's... you know, you don't want to face his anger. You know, I struggle with forgetting that sometimes, how powerful he is and how he's going to judge impartially and how he warns against sin and hates it and enough to carry out this kind of sentence on his own people. He warned them, but you just... I need to remember who he is sometimes, and this is a good way to go.
Right.
I just, the line that stands out to me is that he stretched out a line. He has a standard and he's expecting you to meet that standard. And I just think of myself, am I meeting that standard? It's
right.
Scary to think, you know, if I'm not.
Yeah, that whole idea of stretching out the line, you know, the plumb line from some of the other prophets. Once you see that line, you can see how far you are from it. You know, that's a sobering realization.
So, this idea of God's having rejected Judah and Jerusalem, I think it goes way deeper than just the destruction of the temple. I noticed in this chapter there's language of like everything that signified the people's relationship with God is just gone or perverted. Like the first line in the chapter, the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion, Jerusalem, with a cloud in his anger. I hope it's not disrespectful to say this. That's almost like a parody of the Shekinah, right? When God descended in a cloud on the temple and Solomon sanctified it. It's like now this is some weird, perverse parody of that, where God's wrath is covering Jerusalem instead of his you know, his presence. But he's not remembered his footstool. That seems to be a pretty clear reference to the Ark of the Covenant. It's called that on many cases. He's treated his tabernacle like a garden booth. He's destroyed the appointed meeting place, almost like a parody of the Feast of Booths, where you put up a booth to worship and celebrate, and then you just take it down because it's not a permanent dwelling place, and that's how God's treating the temple. He abolishes the holy days, the appointed feasts and Sabbath. Even the destruction of the temple is compared to a feast day. They've made a noise in the house of Jehovah as in the day of an appointed feast. It sounds like there's a feast going on in there, a worship of Jehovah, but it's not. They're actually destroying the temple instead. You know, the law is no more. The prophets find no vision. The law's been removed. God's not speaking to them anymore. It's like everything that defined his relationship with his people is gone or perverted. You know, and it's just, you know, I mean, if God hadn't done it, we would have said, that's gross, that's disgusting, how dare you, you know. And yet God is the one who has done that,
right,
to demonstrate his wrath and his justice. Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah, it's going to leave you feeling as insignificant as possible. I think you used the word parody, it was really good, because that's, you know, the only way that's going to show is like just how, puts their sins into perspective, puts the relationship into perspective, all that stuff, to where, you know, it's nothing anymore. And I think about, you know, how do we respond to this type of thing? Okay, this is a lament. We're trying to learn how to weep with those who weep, and how do we get into the mindset of somebody who may be suffering this way. You hear something like this, you know, it doesn't have to be, oh, I'm like way off here. We'll talk about objectives later. Forgot about all that. Let's just get to it. When you talk about somebody bringing, you know, like the heaviest burden on their heart to you, and they lay that out in front of you, what do you say? What do you say back to them? Is it, you hear this, oh, it's going to be okay, you know, because it's not, you know, at least it's not right now. Or, you know, maybe you've heard that, well, God has a plan. And I think he does have a plan, you know, an overall plan. But, you know, God certainly does not include every detail of everyone's life, you know, in his plan. He gave us free will, and sin exists in the world. These are two big variables here, you know, one of which gives us a certain amount of influence over what happens, and the other, God cannot be a part of. You know, death was not God's plan from the beginning, okay? One of my favorite examples to illustrate this, it comes from Numbers 27. So the daughters of Zelophehad, they missed out, or they were going to miss out on the inheritance when they came into the land of Canaan. Their father was not part of Korah's rebellion, so they did not lose the inheritance, but he died with no sons. Okay, and all of his daughters are going to be left out of the inheritance because of that. So they brought their case to Moses, and it says in Numbers 27, verse 5, Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to Moses, the daughters of Zelophehad were right. You shall give them possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers and transfer the inheritance of their father to them. And then he goes on to alter his original laws of inheritance to account for this type of situation. Okay?
So God has a plan, but we are part of it. You know, us ugly, weird, unpredictable humans, you know, are included. And we live in a sinful world, and really, really terrible things happen sometimes that God did not originally intend. So how do we respond to someone when they lament something like this, something terrible, something, you know, having to do with sin? You know, maybe we just agree with them. I understand.
Yeah, the friends of Job, one thing they did right was keep silent the first few chapters.
I was thinking about that, because they start that way for the first good long while. I forget what the timeline is, but it's kind of a long time that they sit in silence with him.
7 days.
Seven days. Yeah, and just like kind of let that happen. Of course, they talk after that and it kind of devolves, but give them credit for that of like, yeah, this is bad. We're here for you. And I think that's a very powerful thing to do. You know, does the consequence of sin bother you too? I think it does. You know, sit with them. Let them know that. Yeah, I hate that too. You know, cry with them. Sit with them in silence. Agree with them. It's okay to be sad for somebody to lament a fallen world and the things that happen in it. And especially when we know it's the direct result of God's wrath, of course, in this situation, his anger against sin. You know, align yourself with that. I too hate sin. It's vile and it's destructive, and it has ruined a lot of souls, and I hate that, and I'm going to weep with you for that. Anything else on that section before we keep going? What time we got here? 9:41. Oh, cutting it close. Okay. Let's read verses 10 through 13 and listen for the specific groups. You know, we just talked about kind of Israel in general, and now we're going to drill in. Listen for the specific groups that are mentioned here. Starting in verse 10. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground in silence. They have thrown dust on their heads and put on sackcloth. The young women of Jerusalem have bowed their heads to the ground. My eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach churns. My bile is poured out to the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because infants and babies faint in the streets of the city. They cry to their mothers, "Where is the bread and wine?" as they faint like a wounded man in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosom. What can I say for you? To what compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What can I liken to you, that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is vast as the sea. Who can heal you? All right, so what are some of the specific groups mentioned here? You know, we started off with elders. Who else?
Daughters of Zion, babies, infants, mothers, the young. This gets much more personal, right? And that's important in a lament, to be specific. You know, things aren't generally bad, they're specifically bad. You know, does your understanding of the pain, I think, does it change when you assign that, when you can compare that to a mother and children? Especially today, that's what we're celebrating today, is motherhood and what a strong bond that is and how important it is. When you put pain into that perspective, does it not hit you a little different than the general, what you see on the news, things are happening on the other side of the world? You know, I think it does, and I think that's really important. I think the same can be said for us when we express our pain to others. If I'm talking about the closest of close people, you know, people have earned the right to hear your innermost pain, be specific. Right, it's helpful, and you have to be vulnerable to do that. Just to tell somebody something that may feel a little personal, but you know, if you tell this to somebody who, again, has earned that right to hear that from you, that's going to be something that's going to be helpful, but in the long run, it's going to be able to build you up. And if you look at the end of verse 13, you see this open-ended question. You know, who can heal you? You know, he describes this utter ruin so complete that there's nothing to compare it to, no way to fully describe it. Well, who can fix that? There's only one. You know, this is a rhetorical question. Even if he kind of pushes aside the answer, he doesn't talk about that there. We know the answer, right? It's God. And I think this type of thing is kind of the natural conclusion that emerges in a lament. You can avoid, or you can't avoid, the raw truth unless you just lie to yourself about it, which he's not doing here. But if I pour myself out if I ask the hard questions, I cannot avoid that God is the answer to that. It's always going to come back to me if you ask those hard questions and get specific about it. Verse 14, I think we can get that real quick. Verse 14, we see another example of the subjects of this chapter. It's the prophets. It says, "Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not exposed your iniquity to restore your fortunes, but have seen for you oracles that are false and misleading." So again, he's kind of, you know, admitting that they've done some wrong here. Being specific about that. We had the chance to teach the right thing, to pass along the word that you gave us around, and we didn't do that. And so we're kind of admitting that, and I think these specifics do a really good job here.
I think part of that admitting is listening to other voices. You know, you can think about it in Jeremiah, that was it. Jeremiah's prophesying this. You had the other people prophesying something else. Well, who are you listening to?
Right.
You wanted to listen to the what scratched your ears. Is when I came in, I heard Danny talking about the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. They wanted to listen, and this is where it gets back to, what did the Lord say? But you didn't want to listen to that. You wanted to listen to something else. And this is how you got in this position. A lot of times, you think about, we think about sin and when it's crept into our lives and those things, we listen to another voice.
Right. And, you know, you think, there's a lot of great stuff in the Bible that feels nice to listen to, right? And it's not even saying don't listen to that. It's nice, but it can't be the only thing. You know, Lamentations is really pulling out. There's other things that we need to hear and listen to to make sure we don't fall into that. We'll finish chapter 2 and get into chapter 3 in the next class. Thank you all again for everything you said.